I will start the meeting of the Watershed, Wetlands, and Buffer Protection Subcommittee. I'd like to start the meetings on time. Can't call it to order yet because we don't have a quorum, but at least we'll get started. And just a little bit on the timeline ahead. We have scheduled Friday meetings, the next two Fridays, so we can move through our requirements. We've got, today we're going to hear from the Board of Water and Soil Resources, a review of their budget, and then we will continue that on Friday at 9 a.m. for 1 hour, and then we have an open forum scheduled from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Next Tuesday, the 13th of March, we will be hearing three bills, House File 577, House File 1143, and House File 816. And then we'll follow up the following Friday with working on the budget as well. And as folks know, we have to have budget bills out by the 23rd of March. So a very aggressive agenda ahead. And I would reserve the right to maybe call another meeting if we have to get tasks done. So with that, I will ask if Mr. Jashke, Mr. Thomas could come forward. And I am going to have to excuse myself for a second. I don't know if I can do that. I have to wait till somebody comes in. I have some constituents outside. But Mr. Thomas, if you would start.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Guess I can dispense with members of the committee at the moment. Look forward to being able to provide an overview of the Board of Water and Soil Resources budget with you today. We've provided each member with a three-ring binder, which has got, I'll just kind of walk through that very quickly. In the front left cover, it's got just a little four-page informational brochure on the board and some highlights from 2007. The main packet is the PowerPoint. Behind tab 2 is a number of fact sheets on our budget initiatives that we prepared and included in the packet that relate to the Clean Water Legacy, the Drainage Work Group, Wetland Conservation Act, and then one on native vegetation, which describes how we approach the requirements for use of native vegetation in the boundary programs. There's a couple case studies in there that we provided. We're not going to really speak to those, but we provided that as some background information on kind of how we look at and the benefits of projects from a drainage system management perspective and how our conservation easement programs provide benefit to water quality through a couple case studies.
Mr. Thomas, I'm just going to hand the gavel to Representative Doty while I excuse myself for a moment. So, continue.
And then behind tab 3 in the book is a compilation, just a few of the actual project summaries of projects that were funded with the Clean Water Legacy funding that we were appropriated in 07, in fiscal year 07. We are actually preparing those for every single project that received funding, but we thought it would be a good way to show the some of the outcomes from the actual projects. So with that, I'll start with the PowerPoint and walk through that for you today. Basically, we hope to do four things in our presentation for the subcommittee. We want to spend just a little bit of time talking about the agency purpose and the business model that the Board of Water and Soil Resources uses. We want to spend some time going through the four major program areas and provide some summary information to you on those so you get some familiarity with those programs as it relates to the funding them that we'll be talking about after we do that, providing an overview of the governor's recommended fiscal year 08-09 budget and kind of walk you through some of the revenues and expenditures. And then we hope to wrap up with the change items and the outcomes from the various change items that are in the Bowser's budget, which are kind of over and above what the 06-07 base budget reflected. Moving on to the next slide, which would be slide 3 in your packet. is talk a little bit about the, just mentioned the agency's purpose. It's pretty straightforward. Our goal or our purpose is to protect and enhance soil water resources on private lands. And I think the statistic there bears out that importance of that focus of ours on private lands, and that 78% of the state is held in private ownership. And so without engaging local governments and citizens who control over 3/4 of the land mass in Minnesota, it's really virtually impossible to achieve the state's goals for clean water, abundant fish and wildlife, and long-term soil productivity. Moving on to the next slide, we fill that and accomplish that purpose by filling a couple key roles. Implementing the state's soil conservation policy, which dates back to the 1930s, the state's Comprehensive Local Water Management Acts, the first one of those passed in 1955, which was the Watershed District Act, and then a couple of others that were passed in the late 80s and the early 90s dealing with metropolitan and outstate surface water management. And then lastly, the state's Wetland Conservation Act, which was passed in 1991, which extended the protection to all wetlands in the state. Prior to 1991, the only state protection for wetlands were to the what people commonly think of as the DNR protected waters wetlands. Moving on to slide 5, just touch a little bit on the structure of our board. The map on the left there shows that our board represents all areas of Minnesota. It's a 17-member board appointed by the governor, and we're statutorily linked to the state's 91 soil and water conservation districts, 46 formal watershed districts, and 23 metropolitan water management organizations in 87 counties that are undertaking the state's Wetland Conservation Act responsibilities as well as local water management. The current board was created in 1987, and prior to that, that was three independent boards: the State Soil and Water Conservation Board, the Water Resources Board, and the Southern Minnesota River Basin Commission. And again, in 1987, the legislature passed a bill that merged those three together and now is referred to as the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Of the 17 members, 12 of those are appointed positions. There's three county commissioners that are appointed to our board, three soil and water district supervisors, three watershed districts, and three citizens. And then the five agencies, the DNR, the PCA, the Department of Health, the Department of Ag, and the University of Minnesota Extension also serve as voting members on the board. Moving on to the next slide, I want to emphasize some of the formalized partnerships. In addition to the five state agencies that are represented on our board, and we work closely throughout the year with the DNR, the Police Patrol Agency, the Department of Ag, and others, but I think we also have some very formalized partnerships that we felt were worth mentioning. At the federal government level, we have a formal relationship with the Army Corps of Engineers as we interrelate and interact with them on the state's Wetland Conservation Act. The Corps has similar wetland protection provisions under their Section 404 program, and so we have a lot of interrelations there. We have some formal agreements of how we work together. And then the U.S. Department of Ag's Natural Resources Conservation Service, things like the Wetland Reserve Program, as well as a number of opportunities that we utilize to get work with them on contribution agreements to provide services back and forth as we look at our private lands conservation programs. USDA Farm Service Agency, CREP 1 in the Minnesota River, and now CREP 2 are probably the most visible of the formal partnerships we have with them. And then the U.S. Department of Army, starting a year ago with the Army Compatible Use Buffer initiative up at Camp Ripley, where they're looking at trying to protect development from occurring around the camp so that camp can continue to exist in the future to serve its purposes for the training that they do up there. And then on the state government level, we have a formal partnership with the Department of Transportation as we have a responsibility to replace wetlands from road public safety improvement projects.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Are all of these formalized partnerships working well, or do you have a conflict of who's in charge at some point on some of these? Is it generally smooth? Is there one or two that are not so smooth?
Mr. Chairman, basically they all, in my opinion, are work very well. One of the things we're in the process right now is we're revising our agreement with the Corps of Engineers to acknowledge things that are, you know, changing over time, which become areas of maybe some issue that we have. But again, through those formal agreements, we have a process where we can work through those. So I think they've really enhanced not only our ability to get our work done, but also then the impact on local governments operating the programs that they do, particularly like with the Corps, so that it becomes much more seamless for them, so that we're working together rather than somebody having to kind of do one and thing and then go and talk to somebody else. So generally speaking, they work very well.
Thank you.
Mr. Thomas, I just want to note for the record that Chair Hansen is back and we do have a quorum, so I will call the meeting to order. And just would, has anyone reviewed the minutes to move the minutes? Representative Anzell moves the minutes from the February 27th meeting. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it, and the minutes are approved. Continue, Mr. Thomas.
Moving on to slide 7, try to provide some background on basically our staff and the services. We have 70 staff located in 8 offices around the state of Minnesota. 48 of those staff are paid through general fund expenditures. The remaining 22 staff, for those that are interested, are supported through implementation funds that we receive through the RIM bonding appropriations. Fees that we collect through our wetland banking and appeals functions, as well as, I mentioned before, federal contribution agreements, where we are able to enter into an agreement with a federal agency to, they'll provide us funds and then we carry out activities that are mutually beneficial to both agencies. We're organized into basically 4 primary functional areas, land and water treatment, easement programs, technical services, which is engineering, drainage assistance, soil surveys, things like that, and then our field operations, which is those staff that provide that day-to-day support to local governments that are implementing many of the programs that you'll hear about in just a few moments from us. Moving on, the next slide talks about our statutory responsibilities. I'm not going to go through all of these, but wanted to include those in here to give some sense and some scope to those statutory responsibilities that we have and that we're expected to carry out on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I'd like to just touch on a couple of those. The second bullet on slide 8 is an acknowledgement, and that goes back to the 1930s, is that Bowser is identified as the state's private land, soil, and water conservation agency, and we're directed through a number of statutes to help guide and develop that private lands conservation programming. And then the third bullet on there is, I think, speaks to the nature of our board and the ability for them, through the board, to provide a forum to local governments, counties, watershed districts, soil water conservation districts, to come to the state and incorporate those into our state public policy through the administration.
Representative Morgenius.
Thank you. Let me just check back. You said the guide private land, soil, and water conservation has been in effect since the 1930s. Did I hear that correctly?
Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgenius, that's correct. I think it was 1935 or 1936 that the state passed the state soil and water conservation policy, and it was the act that created the state soil and water districts. And since that time, one of our predecessor boards, the Soil and Water Conservation Board, now which is part of Bowser, has had that responsibility to help guide that private lands program through our soil and water districts.
Representative Morgenius?
I mean, given that long time, I'm concerned because when I brought up at our last meeting the water conservation responsibility. I was seeing a lot of blank stares or people that said, well, that's not part of our responsibility. So I'm not understanding that. It's a discussion we need to have later on because something isn't working there.
Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Medinas, certainly be happy to, you know, spend some time as to talk about that relationship. You know, soil and water conservation districts and their efforts in the state has been a very, you know, long history of starting out primarily as one, maybe one staff working with Soil Conservation Service, a federal agency through that federal kind of state-local partnership. In the 1970s, soil and water district programming grew significantly with the state creating the state cost share program, and then in the 80s with the RIM reserve program. So their responsibilities from kind of a programming, we saw some growing in the terms of their staff there. And then their involvement, you know, obviously as it relates to local natural resource issues, does vary from district to district depending on that local board, and the things that they've identified are those priority natural resource issues in which they choose to then direct some of their efforts and some of their money and some of their technical assistance to.
Representative McGinnis.
So if somebody chooses not to do water conservation, then that's okay. Is that what I'm getting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rubinius, I think, you know, when we can talk about specifically water conservation, if it's talking about regulating the appropriation of water, soil and water conservation districts have no statutory authority, nor does Bowser to deal with water appropriation. That is regulated by the DNR.
No, I said conservation, not appropriation.
Well, and again, Mr. Chair, Representative Rubinius, I think in terms of the level of involvement districts are participating with, many of the districts are involved in the county comprehensive local water management, and many of those districts will have programs where they're doing education, they're looking at, they work closely with the DNR on appropriation permits, they have to look at the land use, they have to look at is there a irrigation management plan in place, for example, when an irrigation permit is being issued. And then obviously many of the practices that are employed, whether it's conservation tillage, crop rotation, many of those types of practices are by, you know, in of themselves a water conservation practice because they promote the infiltration of water into the soil rather than running off through the landscape. But again, the law is structured in such a way that districts do set a lot of those local priorities as far as their individual programming.
Mr. Thomas, I need a follow-up on that because we've been sitting through DNR overviews and Pollution Control Agency overviews, and we've seen the DNR has a Working Lands Initiative, which appears to be geared towards private land. And I understand the, you know, kind of the barriers that are there, that Bowser works with private landowners and DNR works with public landowners. But I was brought a bill the other day, another bill to have DNR working with private landowners on invasive species. And so I think this is following up on Representative Doty about cooperation. I'm a little confused of when the DNR has a private land, and I know they're working in cooperation with you, but how many, is there duplication there, or can this be streamlined somehow?
Mr. Chair, I think when we think about the various programs, you know, like the DNR Working Lands Initiative, that initiative is really geared towards their ability, working with like Fish and Wildlife Service, to bring a lot of the resources that they have through the data tech, the GIS capabilities that they have, to begin to identify those 4 to 6 square mile blocks of habitat that would be very valuable to serve as resting areas for migratory waterfowl as well as production areas for waterfowl. That's something that they can do very well. We work together so that when that moves into an implementation phase, it's going to take programs like RIM Reserve, the Conservation Reserve Program, and it's going to take that workforce that's sitting out there in those local soil and water districts to actually make the landowner contacts and to work with them individually. So I think as you really dive into and dig into those programs, there isn't, I don't believe, an overlap, and sometimes the feeling like people don't know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, because we've participated along with the Department of Ag with the DNR for a couple of years developing that working lands initiative that they have. It's that they have some ability to bring some resources to bear because of the federal funding that they get and the focus that they have on, you know, some of the migratory waterfall issues in western Minnesota. So using that as one example, you know, the thing is it comes down to that work, that local workforce, which I'll touch on later, and that local workforce's ability to be there to interact with those landowners in a way where that landowner is comfortable having that individual come onto their property and spend some time talking about those resource management issues, and ultimately then guiding them through either technical assistance or maybe some financial assistance, or directing them to where they can get that, but we actually then accomplish some of that on-the-ground conservation.
Continue.
On slide 8, just kind of had mentioned on this, the Forum for Local Issues, and again, I think the board is uniquely situated because of the membership of our board, and we have at least two of our board meetings every year outstate. We try to have forums as part of those to engage people into providing us with information on what's working, what's not working, you know, what are they frustrated with. And it gives an opportunity to help build those into the administrative process through our ability, whether it's through policy or budget initiatives, to try to help address some of those concerns and issues that they bring forward. On slide 9, I just wanted to point out the third bullet on there, which again is an authority that is relatively unique to the Board of Water and Soil Resources, in that if there are citizens that believe that there is a significant conflict in the water laws and policies of the state, there's a way for them to come to our board rather than going to district court to try to bring that thing. It's called intervention of water law and policy, is the way it's framed in statute. And then the board can deliberate on that and provide some recommendation back to them. And we could go as far as actually stay a permit or something that has been issued by another agency until a point where a decision or a recommendation is brought forward. It doesn't happen a lot, but in my career with Bowser, I think we've had at least four situations where groups of citizens have brought an issue to us saying, we believe there's a real conflict between, you know, two different parts of our water law and policy, which, as many of you know, are kind of spread out, you know, amongst the various agencies. Moving ahead to slide 10, the business model that we have is basically a model that relies on a very large local government delivery system. Working through, again, counties, so water districts and watershed districts, there's over 450 local employees out there. And we believe working through them and is very cost effective, and it allows us to have our staff focused on a lot of basically high level staff engineers, planners, and specialists that work with those local staff to deliver many of the programs that we implement. Our board structure, again, I think is something we strive to provide a balance between local resource needs and state plans and programs, trying to make sure that we recognize that there is a geographic difference in the state, not only in public, you know, even, for example, like ownership of land. The state is not uniform. When you look at northeastern Minnesota, 80% or more of some of the counties are in public ownership. Compared to southwestern Minnesota, there might be 1% public ownership, as well as then just our resources are not evenly distributed across the state. So the board provides a way, as we talk about our programs and develop that, to try to balance some of those local needs with the state goals and the state plans, like the state water plan as an example. And then also our ability to leverage large amounts of federal and local dollars through our partnership with the federal agencies that I mentioned before, such as the Department of Ag, Corps of Engineers, and the Department of Army. At this point, I'd like to just switch gears and provide a summary of the major program areas that we administer. The first area is our private lands conservation programs. And that is made up of the state cost share program for erosion and water quality control, the feedlot water quality management grant programs, the SWC general and rim services grants, and non-point engineering. And the non-point engineering is one where we're able to provide funding to 11 engineering teams spread out across the state that are then able to provide that higher level of engineering and technical assistance that a local office may not be able to afford to do themselves. So it's a very important part of, again, kind of delivering or making sure that we have the capacity out there to deliver the programs and to drive some of the decisions about projects that are being done and some of the federal funds that are also directed around the state. The next slide shows a little bit about how that grant process works. Our private lands conservation program, the primary focus is on the state's 91 soil and water conservation districts. And I think that the point here is that, in essence, we see our grants as contract for services, in which the state is basically has an agreement with each individual soil and water district, which we buy a number of goods and services that ultimately lead to the protection and the restoration of water quality and maintaining the long-term productivity of the state's agricultural and forest or soils. And not to spend a
Representative Wiggins.
When I look at your buying goods and services, it reminds me of our earlier hearing today where we heard from the Minnesota Conservation Corps. Do you buy any of their services?
Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chairman, we have not historically, but we have sat down with the Minnesota Conservation Corps this last year and are looking at a couple areas where we think there may be an opportunity to work with them. Those two areas that we've identified is the work that we're required to do to monitor and inspect our state wetland banking sites, as well as replacement sites that we are required to inspect once every 3 years for our local government road replacement program. Another area is on prescribed burning for things like our rim easements that are scattered around the state. They've been able to secure the necessary types of insurances that are required, which our local governments cannot get, interestingly enough. For example, soil and water districts, the Minnesota County Insurance Trust, who insures many of those organizations, simply have said, you know, if you get involved in a burn at all, your insurance is no good, but with the Conservation Corps, they've dealt with that. So those are two areas where we're specifically talking about how we can develop some partnerships with them to help provide some of the activities that of the two things that I've identified.
Representative Wiggins?
Yes. Okay, those are things that you are responsible for. What about in people buying services?
Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Linnaeus, in the case of a prairie burn, it actually would be a private landowner who holds that easement who has a requirement to maintain it. And this would basically, we're trying to figure out how we can help get those people lined up with the Conservation Corps, because they would actually purchase the service from them. And in the case of the inspections, we would actually contract with them and they would have their teams performing some of that work for us. And in addition to that, we also have been providing information through some fact sheets and some other information that we have been able to try to forward on to our soil and water districts, our counties, and our watershed districts, making them aware of the Conservation Corps programs and the kinds of activities that they can do so that they can make those contacts and maybe develop an agreement with them to provide some services on a county or an individual local government basis.
Well, I only bring it up today because when Representative Peterson brought his bill before the committee, there were many very kind comments that, as far as I could see, were unsolicited and unplanned toward the Conservation Corps and thinking of their ability to provide on-the-ground services. I wonder if there are opportunities besides just prescribe burns where you actually provide that service. So that's something that I think folks need to chat about at some point.
Mr. Thomas, yeah. We can keep moving if you want to follow up.
Sure. And Mr. Chair, Representative Guineas, and we appreciate that. And again, we are working with them and having a dialogue. For example, I know of a project in Washington County where, through a local water planning challenge grant, the Carnelian Marine Watershed District received money to do shoreline restoration and lakescaping on Big Marine Lake. And the Watershed District, actually, the labor that's doing that for them is the Conservation Corps. So we're trying to make those connections through, you know, a number of different ways. They're a great resource, and I would not surprise that people receive many glowing comments about the work that they do. Moving back to the slide on kind of the grants to soil and water districts, again, give you an idea or a sense of what soil and water districts agree to and are required to fulfill when it comes to the grants they get. They have to prepare an annual work plan, which requires that they have to identify high priority erosion, sediment, and water quality problems. They have to apply annually for grants. They're required to hire and maintain technically competent staff. They have to target at least 70% of cost share funds. And so there's a number of things that they, in essence, agree to, along with undergoing regular financial audits. And then they are the ones that conduct the monitoring of RIM easements on a yearly basis. And those things result in a number of activities. And for example, in 2004 and 2005, with just the dollars that they received from us, they leveraged over $7 million in federal landowner resources. The 11 engineering teams were implemented, and then a many different number of individual projects along with some corresponding sediment reduction, phosphorus reduction, and soil loss reduction. And the next slide...
Mr. Thomas, just on that, can you, on the grants, could you go into just a little detail on performance measurements and you have a tiered structure on amounts given to districts based on returns, or could you go into that a little bit?
Mr. Chair, I didn't bring that information with me, but what we do is the allocation for cost share funds, for example, to soil and water districts is based on a model which looks at the threat or the risk of soil erosion and sedimentation that we worked on a number of years ago. And so counties in southern Minnesota are going to receive a higher grant allocation than, for example, maybe a county in northeastern Minnesota because there's a higher potential for agricultural erosion and potential sedimentation. What we do after that is we actually have a performance scale on our cost share. So we call it cost share utilization. And those districts that consistently spend 90% or more of their cost share allocation receive more. Those that spend an average amount receive the same, and districts that are in a low utilization, spending less than 60% of their cost share funds on an annual basis, they have money taken away from them, and then that's how we fund the high-performing districts. Now, a low-performing district, if after 3 years gets that utilization rate back up to 100%, they start earning back cost share funds that they may have lost. So we do a little bit of that in the administration of those grant programs.
Mr. Thomas, could you provide that data to the members of the committee?
Certainly will.
And then also, is that published anywhere on your webpage, just the performance by the districts?
Mr. Chair, it's probably there, but it's probably not something that is easily discoverable. And but I think it is.
Okay.
Moving on to the next slide, we've tried this year to kind of talk about indicators, and it's something that I think the challenge that has been made, you know, Representative Guineas, I think, challenged all the agencies early on this year, going back to I can't remember the forum all of a sudden. It was over at the Science Museum about kind of the focus on that. And that has been a very a good exercise for us. And in this case, we're trying to develop and build some of these indicators for the various programmatic activities. As we look at soils, we think good indicators of where we are as a state are total soil loss that's prevented and highly erodible cropland that's adequately protected. And we have some other information that talks about some of the background on that. But you can see on the chart there that with combined water and wind erosion, and this is information that comes out of the U.S. Department of Ag's Natural Resource Inventory, that there has been a downward decline in those. The 2003 data is out, but we weren't able to have, it's not able to be released yet beyond some national statistic numbers. As soon as we get that, those kinds of things will be incorporated into here. And then as we look at our targets, we're looking at trying to, you know, we estimate we'll do about another 3,200 projects with the cost share dollars that we're receiving and the technical assistance funds. And that will result in approximately 275,000 tons of soil loss reduction. And those are annual reductions. A practice usually has an effective life of 10 to 15 years. And generally, they're rehabilitated after that. So it's not a case where you get it one year and you may lose it the next year. So we're trying to look at how we can show some of those trends and are we making progress towards a point where, you know, we have either soil loss at a level where everything is at like a soil loss tolerable limit, or do we have all of our highly erodible acres in the state adequately protected? And we didn't have enough room here to show both of those trend lines that you like you see here for total erosion. And on slide 13 is just another way to portray some of the information that we do collect on all of those land and water treatment projects. For 2004-2005, which is the years that we have information available on right now in our system, you can see approximately 3,200 projects completed statewide. It shows the magnitude of cost, you know, that where we get beyond what the state invests. In this case, we had $6 million of cost share that went out through the boards of soil and water districts. Department of Ag, there was about $1.2 million of Ag BMP money that was kind of packaged together, as well as federal grants where we piggyback with the federal government on a program like the Environmental Quality Incentive Program, and land occupiers who pay 25% of the cost of any practice that is installed out on the landscape. They have a financial participation in it as well. And the reporting that we have dates back to 1997. We revised that program in 2002, and it was upgraded, and it's now commonly known as E-Link. And we're continuing to look at ways in which we can improve our pollution reduction calculators that are in there and find better ways to present and provide this information back to local governments as well as the legislature and the administration. And the map on the right just gives you one of the ways that we can show those results. In this case, we're showing soil loss that was reduced, and we're showing it by by the 2,500 or so minor watersheds in the state of Minnesota. So it gives some idea of where, you know, activity is occurring and where those reductions are taking place in the state. And I think what it illustrates here is that it's really our focus in this program on agricultural lands. You can see that's where most of the work and the reductions are occurring, is in that ag zone of the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Thomas, is there a way to capture some of the nonprofit work that I know works in partnership with the local districts like Pheasants Forever or Trout Unlimited? Is there an ability to report the dollar figure that they may be putting in?
Mr. Chair, the answer to that is if the local staff and the partners are interested in capturing additional information beyond what we require, which our requirement is that the money that you get from us, you have to provide those reports back to us, is really based on, you know, the interest that they have in collecting that information locally. If they collect it, we can, you know, show it at a state level. So right now, you know, we don't believe we have a real strong ability to say you have to report something that you're not necessarily involved in. But we know that there's a lot of projects, particularly federal projects, that that local governmental unit, that soil water district, they want to know what the total picture is that's occurring, and they actually will go through and take that extra effort to put projects in, as well as some of the wetland restoration work that where it might be a local waterfall chapter or a Pheasants Forever chapter out there. The next major program area is the local water management program, and basically those, you can see there's a number of different water management acts that have been passed in the state starting in 1955 with the Watershed District Act, the mid-80s with the Metropolitan Surface Water Management, which mandated watershed planning and implementation in the seven-county metropolitan area. That was expanded outstate in 1985 to the rest of Minnesota, although it is a voluntary program, although every county outside the metro area does have a comprehensive local water management plan. And then in 1987, counties in the metropolitan area were given, again, the permissive authority to develop and adopt county groundwater plans. And five of the seven metropolitan counties do have those plans in place. One point that I think it's important to make is that this is really not a planning program per se, in that every part of the state is covered with a state-approved and locally adopted plan. So really, the focus is on implementing those plans. And many of the grant activities that we have are designed to support the implementation of those priority actions that are found in those plans. And then, in addition to the local water management, it's also a way for us to look at the integration of things like the Wetland Conservation Act and a number of other programs and regulations like individual sewage treatment systems, shoreland, and the state feedlot program, which is kind of embodied in some of these comprehensive local plans.
Representative Rodriguez.
I'm interested in reducing pollution impacts from non-conforming ISTSs. Do you provide any money for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Guineas, the money that goes to counties to support the implementation of their ISTS program, which is a every county in the state had to adopt a ordinance regulating individual sewage treatment systems. Through our Natural Resources Block Grant, we provide about $750,000 to counties to support the implementation of that local ISTS programming.
Do we have any way to measure that outcome? The reason I'm asking, I don't want to set you up for anything, but I just got the annual report on septics from PCA, mm-hmm. and overall, 24% of systems are failing. That means we have 116,000 failing. And of the whole total, 10% are an imminent threat to public health. So if we have been providing $750,000 ongoing, why haven't we seen, I mean, these numbers, what I see, are be consistent with what's been happening.
Right. Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guineas, a couple of things on that is, first off, our participation on the in the financing side is basically passing money through what we call our Natural Resources Block Grant, which is a bundling of money that comes from the state. That's actually money that in the past had been appropriated to PCA. We've decided that from an administrative standpoint, it's much more efficient to us to have one grant with a county and bundle a number of programs like DNR Shoreland, feedlot money that goes out in ISTS. The money that we've been doing is actually kind of a pass-through from PCA. I think part of the other, to your answer, to your question at the local level is the reporting of that. That reporting for the ISTS program activities is a report that the counties are required to do annually to PCA. because, again, it's their program. They have that statutory responsibility for it. I think part of the other thing is that as you look at, I think fundamentally the way that program works, most of the corrections are done at a point of sale right now in the state, where somebody is selling a property and they now have to bring that back into conformance. We do have, and I think it's a positive note, is through comprehensive local water management planning and through some of the TMDL work, we now are starting to see some funding of some efforts. For example, like the Northport Crow River Watershed, they actually are hiring somebody that is going to go out during the summer and do an inspection of every ISTS along every lake and river in the North Fork watershed. That information will be provided back to Stearns County, I believe Meeker County and Kandiyohi County, at which time then the county environmental service offices will take those and will begin to work with those landowners to then bring those systems into conformance, because they will have been determined to be out of compliance.
Representative Rodriguez.
This report from PCA, and I understand PCA, it's like pulling teeth for them to get the report from the county, so we're spending a lot of administrative good time just getting the report from the counties. But one of the things they say is that out of the 188 local units of government, and I don't even know whether that's the total number or just the number reporting, only 69 have some requirement for inspection or upgrade at property transfer. That's pretty low. So we have a problem there. But to give a pass-through without any outcomes is really troubling to me, since we know that this is a big deal in cleaning up our waters. I mean, we have a couple of big deals out there. One of them's buffers. This is another one. So I think we need to be thinking of some better way to have outcomes for this money. I mean, I know people love block grants, but we need outcomes in this area.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guineas, we can, you know, as we administer that program, I guess I think the challenge that you've given to us is how we work with PCA to make sure that the kind of reporting and the kind of program plan or the work plan that they have to provide to the state in order to get that grant needs to be beefed up and needs to recognize some of your concerns.
Representative Guineas.
Well, I don't know about what other committee members feel, but I don't know how they feel, but it seems to me for $750,000 a year, we should have some pretty specific outcomes in terms of what counties are doing. So I would want to have some. Is that something? Am I off base, Mr. Chairman, here?
I think that Mr. Thomas can get some data back from. I see that the cities are in the audience, and maybe they can provide some information to us as well. If you'd like to. If you could state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I don't believe that we have any easily accessible data ourselves either on exactly how many non-compliant systems we have in communities. A number of our cities have a mixed setup where some of the community is still on septics and some is served by a collected system, and some are entirely served by septics. So I don't know the specific answers. I could certainly see if we have that data, but at the League, we would be unlikely to collect that. We're not an enforcement agency of any kind.
Representative Rodriguez.
No, I don't need any more data. What I think we have to have is a plan to make sure we get some outcomes for this money. We have been talking about this issue for as long as I can remember, and the numbers seem to be about the same. So how is it that we get outcomes, specific outcomes for this money, and reduce this number of failing septics? It's a pretty direct, pretty practical issue. And so we need to just figure it out.
as the chair representative, I'd be happy to work on that. I'm not aware if cities get any of that money, it would only be because the county decided to pass it along. We do not directly get any of those grants.
Okay. Well, then we need to visit with our counties on this.
We can follow up on this. I did have a specific question on a different issue, if that's okay. I know in the past few years there's been direct kind of feedlot grants, maybe $1 million 1 year and $2 million the next. And here I see the feedlots grants are part of the natural resources block grants. So have those feedlots in the governor's budget, is there $1 million for feedlot grants, or are they rolled into the NRBG grants, or could you just focus a little bit on the feedlot grant program?
Mr. Chair, basically there's two different feedlot things that happen through the board. The first one is the feedlot water quality management grants. That's a cost share program, and that is administered through soil and water districts. It's done on a competitive basis where we take applications once a year, and projects that are ready to go, that have been identified out there, they have to be ranked in terms of, are they repairing the surface water, do they have a feedlot evaluation, what's the level or the pollution hazard that's there, and that is done separately. The feedlot money that is bundled into the natural resources block grant is, again, money that the EPA has, which is to support the feedlot, the administration of the feedlot program. Waring County accepts delegation of the state feedlot program from PCA, which means they are now issuing the permits to a feedlot operation that's less than that 1,000 animal units where it requires a federal permit. And that is the money that is coming through the Natural Resources Block Grant to the county to help support staff to carry out the delegated feedlot program. On slide 16, again, just touching on that contract for services idea, and again, it mentions in there the activities that are kind of bundled together into that natural resources block grant, which includes money to support the implementation of the State Wetland Conservation Act at the local level, PCA money that is passed through for the individual sewage treatment system program. And again, that's where the county is required to adopt an ordinance, and it's to support their staff that helps them administer that local program. The feedlots, and then the local water management money that is passed through to support the implementation of priority actions that counties have identified in their comprehensive local water management plans. And again, there's a development of an annual work plan and budget identifying specific implementation initiatives. And Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I think that's maybe some area where we can find some ways to improve what are the specific activities that are proposed to being done on an annual basis with the money they've gotten. Our system isn't designed in such a way at this point where we can take kind of those work plans and initiatives, plug them into that electronic reporting program, and then compare those to what's reported in terms of actual accomplishments at the end of the year. And those are some of the areas that we hope to be able to make some additional investments in the future. And so you can see they have to adopt and maintain certain local ordinances, report annually, and undergo financial audits. And again, some of the objectives that we get out of that, I won't go through those all. Again, ultimately with the goal of those leading to water quality protection and restoration. Slide 17 highlights for you some of the local water management initiatives that were done, 508 education projects, 94 resource inventories, over 200 monitoring projects, and you can see our ability in this case to show that the feedlot water quality projects that are on a county basis, and the actual location by dots of where those are in the state, and then the estimated phosphorus reduction by county that is attributed to the correction of a polluting feedlot through feedlot water quality management grant program. On to slide 18, and We included this in here. It's not a general fund item. It's not in the 08-09 budget, but we wanted to just mention the RIN Reserve program in that it is the state's largest private land easement program, which provides a lot of benefits to the state through the retiring of marginal ag land from production, permanent soil loss, permanent water quality protection, establishes new wildlife habitat, keeps lands on local tax rolls, which we think there's an advantage to that. It also allows us to get at some properties where it's not for sale. Landowner has no intention of ever making that land for sale, but we can secure some of those public benefits of clean water and fish and wildlife habitat. It's also the program that we use to leverage a couple of pretty well-known programs, the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program and the Wetland Reserve Program, which are both federal programs. Slide 19 is just, again, gives you a visual picture of kind of what this all looks like at kind of a field level. And again, our focus is on private lands management, so it really is making sure that we're able to get the capacity out there, both technical capacity as well as the financial tools through some incentive programs, so that when that technician walks onto that farm or that forested tract, they have the ability to work with that producer, identify the resource needs, both from a water quality perspective, an erosion control perspective, a wildlife perspective, and recommend a suite of activities that might result into a number of different projects being implemented, all the way from a rim easement to cost share for terraces, a wetland restoration, sealing an abandoned well, a number of those things. So it just gives you a little bit of a picture on kind of that focus that we have. We have, again, this year tried to establish some indicators for wildlife habitat on private lands. It's on slide 20. As we look at our indicators in terms of conservation easements acquired, wetland basins restored, and the acres of restored native grassland are just a few of those things that we actually do track. On slide 21, it gives you kind of a visualization of where the roughly 4,900 easements that Bowser has acquired since 1986. It's resulted in just a little over 280 square miles of wetland restorations and wildlife habitat projects, and it gives you a breakdown in terms of the kinds of easement types that we have, be it marginal cropland, riparian, which would be kind of a riparian buffer, sensitive groundwater areas, and wetland restorations, and then there's some other miscellaneous categories that fall into there as well.
Mr. Thomas, there was a fact sheet in the handouts dated February 20th on RIM and CREP, and that kind of talks a little bit about your CREP and WRP easements. Is it correct that there would be, that the money is obligated or will be obligated in the allocation that was provided in 2005?
Mr. Chair, I believe you're referring to this fact sheet that looks like this. And in 2005, the legislature appropriated $23 million to the board for basically our involvement in PREP 2. And by June 30th of this year, $18.6 million will be obligated or encumbered with landowner contracts for easements. That's a combination of PREP 2 easements and easements with the USDA Wetland Reserve Program. The remaining balance, which is just going to be under $1.4 million now, that's an estimate of what we have in the pipeline right now, where we're confident that those encumbrances, those early contracts will result in an actual easement. If we have a higher than normal interest in the next couple months, that number could go down. It's very unlikely to go up. But that remaining $1.4 million, we have an obligation under an agreement with the USDA for our PREP 2, which runs through December 31st of 2007. So we're going to be out of money before the end of that period for that particular federal agreement.
And Mr. Thomas, if we're out of money, I believe when Mr. Hunt was here in the earlier committee, he talked about WRP backlog. Do we have now, a month or a month and a half later, do we have an idea of projects that would be left high and dry, I guess, as WRP to that would not have the state funding?
Mr. Chair, the state conservationist, Mr. Bill Hunt, has communicated with a number of folks over the last few weeks. They've received their fiscal year, their federal fiscal year 07 allocation for the Wetland Reserve Program, which is $13 million. They run the risk of basically turning all of that back to USDA because a year ago, the federal government changed the appraisal process that USDA is required to use. And I believe at the hearing that you had earlier, Mr. Hunt talked about that. The offers that they're making now are 40 to 60% less than the offers they were making a year ago. Landowners simply just do not see that as being financially attractive enough to take that land, put it into a perpetual easement, and, you know, not have any other use of it other than their use for hunting and you know, the enjoyment of it. And so without some potential leveraging or partnering with a program like RIM, they believe that they could lose 90% or more of that money because of just lack of landowner interest. And that's money they have in hand.
Okay, with that, we're at 1:40. Are there any questions? Representative Anzell.
I'm a little bit slow to get questions formulated, but I want to go back, if I could. Thanks.
Go back to Representative Wagenius's line of questioning. And specifically to page 16, and then I would like to reference page 17. What I think I'm seeing is a really high prioritization of feedlot water quality management through very prescriptive, categorical, tight grants where outcomes, results are measurable. And then, in contrast, I see, I'll get to it, I see the block grant with on page 16 primarily, and I get confused a little when I see the words counties agree to. My questions now: are the counties required to provide a local match? Two, are the counties required to assess need, assess the scope of the activity, and then to report on in a measurable way the results? Those are the two questions, and one more comment. Block grants are interesting phenomena between levels of government, and in my long ago experience, they tend to work where there is a buy-in by the local unit of government financially. When there isn't a buy-in, there oftentimes isn't the political will or the structural commitment to performing what we all in state government have as expectations. That's a really long-winded deal, and I see you looking at your watch, and I don't think...
Mr. Thomas.
That's it.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Anzlik, some of the history on the block grant is that we call it that because it's a bundling of grants. If you look on page 16 and underneath the title where it says Wetland Conservation Act, ISTS, Shoreland, Feedlot, and Local Water Management, if I can just take a moment, Wetland Conservation Act requires a one-to-one local match.
Okay.
And again, it's a state regulatory requirement. If the county does not carry out the Wetland Conservation Act satisfactorily, which is really basically making sure that every project that's proposed goes through proper sequencing, they certify it. If they don't do that, we place a moratorium on that county and nobody can do anything until they get back into sync there. The individual sewage treatment system part of it, the state required a couple of years ago that every county adopt an ISTS ordinance. And this was basically the state saying, this is a state mandate, and this is the state's share that we're going to provide to participate in helping you carry out that state mandate. And again, they carry out that IST ordinance. And the similar thing is with the shoreland. That's money that historically had gone to DNR. DNR said, you know what, Bowser, you guys are good at doing grants, you're good at grant administration, why don't we give you the money, let you guys put it all together, we'll have one application or one agreement, and making it a much more administratively efficient process. On the feedlot program, that's evolved, counties can voluntarily accept delegation to the state feedlot program, but when they do, then they are required to permit. They have to go. They had to do a inspection. They had to. I'm going to forget what it was. Where everybody had to register their feedlot with the county. They have to then monitor those, and so they're carrying out again that statutory responsibility. On the local water management portion, which is the portion we're most directly involved with, along with WACA, from a statutory responsibility, there also is a local match for that local water management portion. And counties have gone through the each county has a comprehensive local water management plan, which has gone through public participation, public hearing. They've identified what their local water resource priorities are. It could be groundwater, it could be surface water. And what we're helping the state again is saying, years ago, a commitment to help provide financial support to carry out those priority actions in those local water management plans. So that's kind of how those five activities fit together. And on slide 17, we just tried to show you a very quick snippet. We can provide a lot more information, but in case of that local water management portion of the block grant or that block grant, we tally, it can be used for things like education, inventories, local resource inventories, monitoring projects, updating and supporting their regulatory programs, as well as feedlot initiatives. And then feedlot initiatives, in this case, is actual permitted activities that were taking place by counties administering the state feedlot program.
Chair, that's very helpful. However, as I look at page 17, I see the map, feedlot water quality projects 0405, estimated phosphorus reduction by county. I'm wondering why I don't see a similar map, estimated rural individual septic system reduction problems by county. And that is a question that I wouldn't have asked 3 months ago, but under the mentoring of Chair Wagenius, I've learned that that's the kind of question that we should be asking. And so I ask you.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anslick, we've only tried to provide just a snippet of information about what our electronic reporting system can generate. We'll go back and see if we can pull out maybe some of the things that you've had out of what we require for reporting. And certainly, you know, upon some of the direction that we get from the legislature, you know, we can begin to look at, you know, that reporting and how we kind of bring that back. And we can show all kinds of stuff that's reported by county, by watershed, by legislative district, because it's all basically electronic, and, you know, we can do a lot of that assessment and analysis.
Mr. Chairman, I promise, just more of a comment. We build public support for what we all do here by being able to explain to the people that we're doing better. And in this regard of rural failing individual septics, I need to feel better that we're doing better. So.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Anzalek, again, and I don't want to pass the buck unnecessarily, but we also have to look at, you know, the state agency, PCA, and maybe sit down and have some of that discussion about what are the requirements or what are the expectations, you know, of them and the LGUs in terms of reporting some of that information back and how it interacts, you know, some of it may be going directly to them rather than to us because, again, we're primarily passing through that money, although we capture some information because of the kind of the common reporting that we attempt to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry you took so much time. No problem. Any other questions?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I'm a little late. I had a bill from another committee.
We will continue the budget presentation. Thank you, Mr. Thomas. This has been very helpful on Friday. So with that, meeting adjourned.